This is News and Notes. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Hillary Clinton makes Darfur a campaign issue. A small West African nation proudly claims Whoopi Goldberg as its own. And can it be kids are studying too much? Joining the panel today are Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hello.
And happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
At the top of the program, we talked about how the Congress is struggling over whether and how to respond to President Bush's plans to increase troop levels in Iraq. But Senator Hillary Clinton is also speaking up about the crisis in Darfur. She's calling for the U.S. to take action, saying we can stop the genocide in Darfur, and yes, we can find the right end to the war in Iraq. Earlier this week, she questioned Secretary of Defense Robert Gates about what the U.S. intends to do next.
I want to ask you about a letter that on January 16th, I, and along with 21 of my colleagues, sent to President Bush asking for an explanation of what Plan B steps he was considering with respect to Darfur, including possible punitive military action such as a no-fly zone or blockade of Port Sudan. Obviously, we are facing once again the repeated and blatant violations of numerous ceasefires, peace agreements, and UN obligations by the government of President Bashir.
Everybody, well, Joe, why don't you start? What do you think she's really saying? Do you really think she thinks the U.S. would send its own troops to enforce a no-fly zone or a blockade?
Well, my guess is she thinks that's probably pretty far off, but I do think that by staking out a position early in the campaign on Darfur, she's letting everyone know, and perhaps particularly the African-American community, that Africa is important to her. And clearly the African-American base is very important to any Democratic candidate. And with Barack Obama also in the race, one thing this does, it sends a signal to African-Americans that basically I'm on your side.
Dr. Berry, what do you think?
Well, I think it does more than that because the Darfur issue is very hot with the Hollywood crowd and the big funders in the party, even more than just strictly the African-American community and its politics. And we often are very blasé about Africa anyway. But I think that it signals that. It also, she remembers how Bill Clinton didn't do anything about Rwanda and the genocide there, and how much regret they have all expressed. But I also think there's a hope that Bush will do something about the problem of Darfur and the problem of Iraq before January 2009, which is what we're looking at almost 2 years from now. A lot of people can get killed between now and then. So I think what she's staking out is that, you know, if he won't do something, then if I'm president, I will, but we really wish this mess would go away. And she's only talking about aircraft being deployed in the no-fly zone. She's not talking about American troops actually going there, and I think the American people are not really in favor of ground forces from the United States getting involved in something else. But I do not think we should tie together the prospects of genocide in Iraq, which those who want the surge keep putting forward, with what we do in Darfur.
Nat Irvin, though, can you really separate the two? And I guess the first question I really wanted to ask you is would this be helpful? Do you think U.S. involvement would be helpful at this time, especially when there's so much criticism directed at the U.S. by the international community already for being too go-it-alone in its approach to these affairs and also so much suspicion about U.S. Interest in the region, especially when it involves Muslim countries? So,
well,
Nat, first of all, would this be helpful?
If the United States were to do anything about Darfur, it should do it in conjunction with the African countries that are to be involved and an international force and not simply a unilateral activity on the part of the United States. That's absolutely correct. You can't tie the two together, however, because the Iraq situation is very different. We are responsible directly for going there with no good reason and creating all the tensions. And if genocide results, it is entirely in our laps as opposed to what's going on in Darfur.
Nat Irvin, do you
Michelle,
think— go ahead, Nat.
No, I was just going to follow up Mary's point. I think that at least it seems to me— well, first of all, I applaud the senator for trying to restore a certain amount of idealism about American foreign policy after the mess we have made in Iraq, because it has set us back in terms of the way that we see ourselves. And I think Mary is quite right when we talk about what we could do in Darfur. And what I think that the senator is suggesting is that we take a more aggressive role in trying to work with other countries, with the African Union, with the United Nations. And in fact, you know, the government, the president, our current president has not, I mean, he has done some things, but he has not raised it to the level of visibility that he could. I think the key thing, the two things that have to happen for this crisis to be solved, one of them is what President Carter said recently, and that is that there has to be a settlement between the two parties before any, before the United States or any of the African Union forces, any of the troops, the international forces, any military forces at all will have any effect. And the second thing is, was that notice that this was the first time that Darfur was mentioned at the Davos World Economic Policy Forum. And that's an indication that perhaps maybe the business interests of the world are going to pay some attention to this part of the of Africa, which it has not yet. So without the business interests being brought forth, I don't see how much can actually be brought to bear here.
You know, Joe, do you see? Go ahead, Joe. But I was going to ask you: do you see other senators following her lead? Do you see other candidates following her lead on this?
Well, I think if they're pressed, they might down the road. Not as of yet, but if they're pressed, certainly in the debates, they may. One thing I wanted to mention, though, in this context, is that just about a month ago, the United States did send an AC-130 gunship to Somalia, neighboring Somalia, in the hunt for some suspected Al Qaeda terrorists, and dozens of people were killed. And so it is not unknown for the United States to use its military power in Africa, and certainly this was the first time last month I'm speaking of since 1993 with the famous Black Hawk Down incident, which in a sense soured the United States on interfering in Africa until last month. So perhaps her notion of air cover for Sudan is not so far-fetched given recent military history.
You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin. In case you're just tuning in, with me on today's roundtable are Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Dr. Berry, you had one final thought about Darfur?
I was just going to say that all of what Joe just said about the comparison between using military force in Somalia, and so maybe we can do it here, it also means that we will think that it assumes that we think that genocide is at least as important to get rid of as terrorism, because the facts on the ground are very different.
Is that an assumption we can make?
Our history so far in terms of Africa, if Rwanda is any example, and we hope it's a bad example, is that we really don't care that much. But I basically think Senator Clinton is right that these things ought to get settled now instead of what we're into is a mode where we're going to have to wait and let everything happen and keep getting worse until January 2009. This is just totally unacceptable.
Let's stay with another story out of Africa, hopefully on a lighter note. And it seems that government officials in Guinea-Bissau are anxious to connect with their distant daughter, Whoopi Goldberg. Now, you remember a number of celebrities took DNA tests in connection with a PBS special last year. And it turns out that the Academy Award-winning actress's ancestors very likely come from that area. Now, Guinea-Bissau is one of the poorest countries on the continent. Its leaders were hoping that the relationship with Whoopi Goldberg might do something to draw attention.
Hoppy Goldberg.
Hoppy Goldberg. The letter said, Her Excellency Hoppy Goldberg. They wrote her a letter asking to be delivered through the embassy, asking her to come to visit. Now, it's unfortunate Whoopi Goldberg is afraid to fly, so it seems unlikely that she'll be visiting anytime soon. But, you know, what do you think of that strategy, Joe?
Well, I think it really points to how desperate, unfortunately, some African countries are for international attention. I think that if you have to kind of grab onto an American entertainer in order to draw attention to your small West African country, it shows just how far off the radar screen you are for most Americans. And so I frankly see it as a desperate act to get attention.
Have any of you done this, gotten your DNA tested?
No.
Not yet, no.
No, and Troy Duster at NYU points out that there are all kinds of scientific questions about whether this all makes any sense and that it only really traces one spike in your ancestry back to some paternal ancestry, like generations ago, one spike, nothing on the maternal side, and that it could have been some European slave trader who was there. But in any case, leaving all that aside.
All the women say this.
Leaving that aside, which is too complicated, I just think that if people are going to have their DNA tested, and if they are entertainers and big shots and they have money and they're proud that they're from this particular place in Africa, maybe they should help the poor people over there rather than just saying, isn't it great, I'm from whatever tribe it is. And white entertainers, when they, like Madonna adopting that child and so on, little countries try to take advantage of that in some way to get publicity because they're all poor. So this is not unusual. And Whoopi, just as we got over here by boat, even if she can't fly, she could get on a boat and go over there if she really wanted to.
Well, she could also send a check, too, right?
But this is an interesting question, because I wonder if some people listen to this, and if this sort of plays into some subliminal fears. I mean, you can imagine people saying, you know what, I already have relatives in my pocket over here. And do I need any more relatives in my pocket that I don't even... I mean, isn't this kind of your worst-case scenario if you won the lottery? That, you know, relatives you don't even know would be asking for... But
you got a whole country you got to take.
You got a whole country to take. But this is... But this is not the only African country that is starting to, and Caribbean country, trying to reach out to the diaspora. You know that this is the 50th anniversary of Ghanaian independence is coming up. Ghana has the Joseph Project, where they're trying to interest African Americans or Africans of the diaspora to come home, as they say. You know, the Jamaican Prime Minister, Portia Simpson Miller, is reaching out to Jamaican expatriates. So part of me wonders whether, do you think this is a fruitful strategy?
Well, it's certainly a common strategy. I mean, certainly if you look at countries like Ireland, if you look at Israel, for example, there are major efforts to tie people in this country to their homelands. And so there's certainly nothing wrong, and there certainly is perfectly okay for African countries to do the same thing. I think the difference between countries like Israel and Ireland, for example, is that they do it much more systematically, and that the people in this country who are of Irish descent or who have links to Israel also are much better organized to help their homelands than African Americans by and large are.
Michelle,
I've got to say this, that there's a whole field of African diasporic studies in universities and colleges and research going on and courses that tie together the Caribbean, Africa, and the United States and the African-American experience, so that in a sense, and people go to Africa for conferences and all that in the Caribbean, so it does fit in systematically with that notion.
But what I was going to say is, and thank you for bringing that in, Dr. Barry, always helpful to have your corrective help there, but that it used to be that really mainly elites, intellectuals, journalists, entertainers were the ones who forged these ties. And Nat Irvin, what I was wondering about, do you think this is we are at a point at which African-American feel secure enough on the whole to start forging these ties in the way that you have, you know, regular folks, I think, you know, don't have to be sort of an Italian intellectual to have strong sort of an interest and connection to Italy.
In fact,
I'm just wondering, it's more of a grassroots phenomenon. So, Nat, what do you think? Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, the way that I test this assumption is I interview cab drivers all the time when I'm in D.C., and just regular folks to find out what the relationships are with the Caribbean, with the continent. And you would be surprised to find the number of people who are planning on retiring either in the Caribbean or on the continent. Ghana seems to be one of the places. There's a lot of activity between African Americans and Rwanda and Botswana. There's a lot of what I think people are just under the radar. And one of the, you know, when you look at what the Joseph Project is about, it says the 21st century would be the African century. That may be a stretch. But look, the aspiration is there. And if and there's something going on within the consciousness, I think, both of the continent and of Black people in America, to where I'm just starting to notice more often you'll see people with dual citizenships and thinking about doing projects there, business projects. It's not at all something just for the elites. It's a lot more common than people may care to realize.
Okay, great. Thanks. We're down to our last couple of seconds. I wanted to bring one more topic in. I was very interested in this because all of you teach or you have taught at universities. And I saw this story that said the College Board, which administers the SAT and AP tests to high school students, released its annual report this week. And it turns out that some kids are taking too many AP courses. Now, these courses, of course, as you know, measure achievement in college-level work, clearly. I didn't take any. And the executive director of the AP program says some kids are overdoing it. Now, now all of you teacher have taught at university level. Does this square with your sense of the way it is, that the kids are just putting too much pressure on themselves, Dr. Barry?
Well, they're so worried about getting into a, quote, good college, and their parents are so worried about it, that this all feeds into that over-anxiety and over-activity. So they miss out on a lot of what should be high school life. And what interested me is one student said, well, even after doing all this, when I go to college, it'll be easier. No, it'll be harder because there'll be even more competition. So they need to relax and take a little time to think sure, have achievement. But they can get into a good college with good grades and having done something besides taking AP courses, maybe help out in the community a little bit or do something of that kind. So I think that there's an overemphasis on this kind of activity.
I disagree with Mary. Next. I think that, but although I understand Mary's point, I just think that when we talk about the opportunities and challenges that are facing minority communities, I think competition is the key. The key, for me, it's a simple thing is this. In India, there are newspapers daily where children are solving algebraic equations, competing. Every day there's a question, and kids are competing to solve the equation for the next day. When we look at what the competition is for the future that comes from both Asia, from China, and from other parts of the world, it is imperative, and especially to me, for minority kids to be competitive. I don't think we're nearly at our capacity when it comes to what we are capable of doing. Balance is the key, but I don't think we're not suffering from a lack of balance.
Well, Joe, final thought.
I think balance is the key, as Nat said, so I think that's where the bridge between Mary and Nat comes. You can be competitive without being so competitive that you drive yourself into a nervous state, which apparently is happening with some of our children today. At the same time, it's clear that in the black communities, we really do need to put an emphasis on early childhood preparation, elementary school preparation, junior high preparation, so by the time our children get to high school, they will be much better prepared to take the courses that they need in order to get into college.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Thank you all. Joe Davidson, an editor at the Washington Post. Nat Irvin, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, joined us from member station WFDD Radio in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And here with me and Joe at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.